Everybody. Hi there. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. It's time for News Dissector Radio, heard every week at this time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN-FM. Our call-in number, 888-874-4888. We'll give you that number again. We have an interesting program for you today, and we're going to be traveling to hear about Mali in West Africa. We're also going to hear a little bit more about what's happening in Washington, D.C., with Bob Parry, the editor and investigative crusader who runs Consortium News. But first, I want to just welcome to the program Polarity One, Polar Levine. He's been our sort of musical director in absentia. We never really hear from him much. Occasionally he's been on, but we've been playing his music regularly since this program went on the air, and I basically imposed on him to join me, you know, on the program every week with some conversations, some new music that he creates, some guests that he knows in the cultural area, to add some dynamic to the program. Polarity, just give people a little bit of a background on yourself so they know who they are listening to.
Well, I've primarily been a musician and also writer and graphic designer, and I've done the music for Danny's films for the last 10-12 years, and most of my stuff is political. I do a lot of work with Occupy, and Danny and I have been working together for, well, I guess since around 99 on a variety of.
And we still can stand each other, and we can still talk to each other. Occasionally, I'm usually in the wrong. You know, he corrects me. But the point is that you should check out his website. Also, there's a lot of free musical downloads that you can get of Polarity One's music. Give him the
Yeah, that's polarityone.com, P-O-L-A-R-I-T-Y, and the number one.
So let's start off with one of the most recent albums as we wait for Bob Parry in Washington, D.C., the new song, Polarity's version of Which Side Are You On?
A country, they built the middle class, unions and inventors, the teachers and the brass. But now it's run by players, a zero-sum game, buying politicians, and the unions get the blame. Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you?
Well, that's a question that we're going to be dealing with not only on today's program, but every week. Which side are you on? How do you personally regard what's happening in our country to our world? And what are you personally prepared to do about it? Those are some of the questions that we're going to pose to you. And joining us in the discussion is a political observer, journalist, who I've respected for so many years, Bob Parry, who's editing Consortium News. And if you don't know the site, you should check it out because it's a fount, if you will, of really intelligent reporting and analysis, a lot of it of the kind that you just don't see anywhere else. And the thing about Bob Parry that I particularly, you know, have to kind of recognize is that, like myself, he came out of mainstream journalism. He was with the Associated Press. I was with ABC News and CNN and CNBC. So we've all had one foot in the mainstream media camp, and we're both trying in our own ways to offer journalism that's meaningful, offer ideas that are important, offer a chance to fill in the gaps, the many, many gaps in our media mix, if you will, about what's really going on in the country. How are you today, Bob?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. So you're in the Washington area. What mm-hmm. did you? The latest news that I'm hearing is that Senator Schumer, who we saw the other day as the host with the most at the inauguration, has now acknowledged, admitted, boasted in a sense that he is about to try to propose cuts to Social Security. So, kind of the spirit of the liberal agenda, which Obama was being accused of, and we heard language about, seems to be just a few days later, things seem to be moving in another direction with proposed cuts to Social Security. Any thoughts on that?
Well, we haven't really seen what Schumer's talking about. Obviously, there's always this desire to appease what many in the mainstream press sort of almost define as whether you're a serious person in Washington, is you have to say, I'm for reforming entitlements, I think is the way they phrase it. But what they always mean is cutting entitlements. So there's this game that goes on about that if you want to be considered a serious person, you have to at least talk in those terms. Now, I've not seen what Schumer is really talking about. There's been a discussion about changing the way that the cost of living adjustments will be might be determined, but I think it's really pretty much up in the air as far as where that might go. And I think the Democrats have been obviously resistant because they do see Social Security as part of their legacy and one thing that sort of distinguishes them from the Republicans. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
You know, at the same time, many Democrats joined in with the Republican measure in the House to, just extend the debt ceiling, just for 3 months or three-point-whatever months. They seem to be part of it as well. They don't seem to be in opposition, really, to, an aggressive opposition to the Republicans in the way that many of the Tea Party Republicans are aggressively, resistant to John Boehner, and his little group there.
Well, that's true. I think the Democrats have just not had the overall for 30, 40 years now, and you've followed it as I have. There's been this timidity that we've seen play out in a whole variety of ways on the part of the Democrats. And I must say, some of that, the left has to take some blame there because we were both, I remember listening to WBCN back when I was living in Brighton, Massachusetts back in the 70s, and there was a guy named Danny Schechter on doing News Dissector. And a lot of those very important outlets for getting out alternative information disappeared, frankly, over those decades. And so what we saw was the right investing very heavily in their media and their outreach to the American people, and that was effective. We did not see as much of that from the progressive side and still don't, really. And I know you've talked about this a number of times, about the failure of many sort of liberals and wealthy progressives to support media in the way they should, in the way people on the right have. So you have this imbalance in our political system, and what that has tended to do is make the Republicans or the conservatives or the right more aggressive because they've got this big megaphone. And conversely, you've got the Democrats sort of finessing, trying to maintain some of their social programs and maybe in some cases do minor increases in those areas, but not in the hard, tough way that the right does.
Well, let me just ask polarity here. Why don't they get it? Isn't it sort of obvious that media has more impact in many ways than politicians do, that than government has?
The thing that drives me nuts, I mean, you would think that lefties would know far more plugged into media and how consequential it is. But here you have MSNBC. And I've just given up on it completely. What it is it's not in any way a mouthpiece for the left or even the left of center. What it is it's a recap of what the right wing did that day. You see clips from Limbaugh. You hear what the nuttiest people in the country are saying and then putting it down. Nothing. You hear nothing about what the left is up to.
Well, just independent media. I mean, it's hard now sometimes to know what is left and what is right, you know. But we do know that other voices are marginalized. Maybe this is why, after 10 years of trying to get heard and seen in America, Al Jazeera had to spend $500 million to buy a network, which we still don't know what the content of it's going to be. I have a piece, by the way, on aljazeera.com up now, talking about the future of the new Al Jazeera America. But, you know, there's been an absence of, you know, visible alternative media. I know I've tried. MediaChannel.org was our effort. We're coming back with it. Bob went from the Associated Press to Consortium News. But, you know, it's not a question of just having the media out there. It's having it quoted. It's having it reinforced. It's having it have more influence in the national discourse, even if it's more accurate and more on target.
You know, the left, you probably realize this too, that the left hasn't found its mode, hasn't found its voice. When Air America was on, aside from Franken, Al Franken, everything sounded like Fox. It sounded like Limbaugh. Everybody was, you know, was there to get people pissed off. And I think that lefties don't go for that crap.
Do you agree, Bob? I mean, that's a lot of the so-called progressive in media are really reacting to, responding to the right, as opposed to initiating the issues that they feel are most important.
Yes, I think that's probably true, although I think there's some value in hearing some of what is going out on the right perspective, because that has a real influence on the American political situation, and because you do have a lot of folks responding to that right-wing message. So to know what it is has some value. But I would make the point that back in the days when I was listening to Danny Schechter, the news dissector on WBCN, the progressives generally had a much stronger media voice there, and it wasn't just
absolutely. You know,
Rampart was around. You had Dispatch News. You had hundreds of underground newspapers. And that was, of course, during the Vietnam War period. And there seemed to have been some decision made. I'm not sure decision is exactly the word, but sort of a collective kind of sense that wasn't worth the effort, that things should go in a different direction. Because all those, you know, virtually the entire left media was shut down or sold off. In some cases, you had like the New Republic, which was sort of a traditional but sort of, you know, certainly left of center liberal publication of some historic importance, sold to Marty Peretz, who made it into this neoconservative rag for a number of years, gave birth to the Charlie Krauthammers and Fred Barneses of the world. So you had the left media being either shut down or taken over, often by people then transform them into very different entities without people knowing it. One of the themes when I was at the AP in the 1980s and I was dealing with the people that now became the neocons, people like Elliot Abrams over at the State Department, one thing they would love to say is when the New Republic would write a piece embracing the Contras, the Nicaraguan Contra rebels, and defending whatever the hell they did, the line that Elliot would use would be, even the liberal New Republic says this is a great thing. So, in effect, the progressive media, or what was left of it, the shell of it, was actually turned against or turned in favor of these right-wing policies. And so you had this, but I remember when I then went to Newsweek, as you know, from 87 to 90. And after I left Newsweek, after a lot of battles there, I started approaching some left of center, progressive people with some money and foundations and so forth. I'm sure you did the same. And I was basically told, well, the media is not important. We don't do that.
Yeah, where money was invested. And, you know, I don't want to take anything away from some of the fine work that Media Matters does, but it's a partisan, knee-jerk reaction to Republicans. It's not like, here are the issues that we think are important. Here is what's happening in the world that we care about, that we want you to care about. It's you know, taping something off of Fox and then showing how stupid it is. It's very troubling to me that there has been this kind of refusal, this desire sort of to be part of the big show, if you will, the big networks. I mean, I am guilty of this too, Bob. I mean, I went to work for ABC News. I was there for 8 years. I went to work for CNN when it started. I was part of CNBC briefly. I've been in that mainstream, and I have seen what that does to people who are become very status conscious, very competitive with each other. They're looking for approval from, you know, if you will, the 1%. They don't have an independent perspective. They're terrified of dissenting, and they're kept in line, if you will, by the corporate media structures. And, you know, it's not a conspiracy. It's a culture of consent, if you will, with these values. And it's hard when you're on the inside. I mean, I wrote the book in 1997, The More You Watch, The Less You Know, which described my experiences, what it was like actually to be in the edit rooms, in, you know, the meetings at ABC, and how the choices generally were choices that would support people in power.
You know, Danny, when you were on BCN, the hook really was music. It was music that drove the movement at that time. And there's hardly any political music being done now in the generation we have now. Also, advertisers were way behind the curve at that time. In the 80s, advertisers caught up to a point where they have feelers out there on the street figuring out what is the next pre-counterculture out there. Advertisers latch onto it. They create the soundtrack for the culture. They determine what the costume for the culture is going to be. And the big protest is fuck you. And that's what that generation.
We're on the radio here, polarity. Your language, please, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Better.
K-U.
Much better. But, you know, I did the first national segment, if you will, story on network television about hip hop, which was a very promising cultural phenomenon coming out of the South Bronx, the boogie down Bronx. And, you know, we saw how it suddenly became all about the Benjamins, all about making money, all about other values, not the values of the voiceless who weren't being heard and for whom hip hop was their CNN, their, as Public Enemy put it. It became part of the whole cultural matrix where people wore, you know, Mercedes-Benz medallions around their neck and wanted to look and act like they were rich millionaires.
Yeah, and the activity of successful hip-hoppers outside of music is fashion. You know, having their own fashion line rather than doing benefits for political causes.
Well, you know, here we had the inauguration. Were you there, Bob, by any chance? Were you watching?
No, actually, I had the flu this weekend, but I did go. I usually go. I went to the one in 2009.
Okay.
So this is what I did watch on television.
You know, so here we had James Taylor singing, which was something, you know, and we had Beyonce. Either she was or she wasn't lip-syncing the national anthem with the Marine Band backing the diva
play up. Play-syncing.
You know, this was, and in a way, the whole event was political syncing, you know, trying to sync in with the attitude where the liberal message sort of worked for Obama in the election. And so he reinforced it, but it's not clear that it applies at all to our foreign policy, the drones, the interventions in other countries. So, you know, we're in a situation where most of the media paid more attention to what Michelle Obama wore than what Obama really said or what his record is.
Well, my view of what happened to the media really comes more from trying to do investigative journalism within it. I know that's also been part of your endeavors too, especially on the economic issues. But
just on this point, by the way, this week PBS Frontline has done a piece called "The Untouchables," which I haven't seen,
right,
decrying the lack of prosecution of financial criminals. Thank you, PBS.
Well, 60 Minutes also, I thought, did a piece that wasn't that, you know, I say replayed it on CNBC last few days. Which showed, which dealt with some of those same topics that you've dealt with,
right,
about the failure of the Justice Department and the SEC to act aggressively.
You know, it's important, and, you know, okay, maybe I was like a little ahead of the curve here, but it is important, and we need reinforcement you know, of other media also. A story becomes a big story, like Watergate became a big story, not when just when the Washington Post was on it and was wrong about some of the detail, but when the New York Times hopped on it, when CBS hopped on it, when it became, it grew in importance and was reinforced as an important issue that couldn't be avoided.
Well, but that was something that the Republicans and the right, I think very correctly, saw as a threat to how they were functioning, which was increasingly using just power, abuse, violating of law, and so forth. It became the Nixon way, with people like J. Edgar Hoover helping out. So you had this sort of lawless style, but they recognized after 74 that the media, if it were not sort of whipped back into line, could become a recurring threat to that style of governance, and which also plays into the foreign policy, which is the desire to have wars to project American power through things like the coup in Chile in the 70s and Central America when I was covering it in the 80s, and on to the present, the Iraq War and Afghan War, et cetera. So the media became a problem. And it was partly because there were places like, you at WBCN or Ramparts or Hirsch's work at Dispatch News that was getting reinforced in the mainstream media more. The mainstream media was showing more flexibility and openness to some of those stories. The New York Times did pick up things that Dan Ellsberg was leaking to them, and they did run it. And so there was a strategic decision made, and you see it from the Justice Powell's memorandum in 1971, the work of Bill Simon, the former Treasury Secretary, et cetera, to start investing heavily in a conservative media infrastructure, think tanks as well, and activist groups in Washington, lobbying groups of various kinds. And that included attack groups against the press, groups like Accuracy in Media, what Brent Bazell put together, those kinds of things. And so you have this concerted effort to constrain what the mainstream media was doing.
And discredit the so-called liberal media.
They called it liberal media, even though it never was. It was always,
exactly,
best you could say, was mainstream. It was essentially corporate. It was really owned by people and run by people who were fairly conservative. When I was at AP, the general manager, the top guy, named Keith Fuller, was an unapologetic supporter of Ronald Reagan and what he was doing in foreign policy. So those of us trying to do the journalism in that environment, it became more and more hostile. And it became harder and harder to break those stories. If you did get them out somehow by pushing them through your own system, they often met silence or ridicule at places like the Washington Post. I remember when I went to Newsweek, the first week I was there in 87, I wrote the first story based on sources inside the White House about how the cover-up of Iran-Contra was already taking shape and how there was this desperate effort to protect Reagan from what he actually had done in terms of authorizing these illegal activities. And actually, the Newsweek made it a cover. They regretted it pretty quickly, but they did. And that was followed immediately by the Washington Post-style section doing this mocking piece about how overreacting Newsweek was. And Newsweek responded, and it was also being attacked by places like the New Republic and other places. And so Newsweek essentially pulled back. It didn't dare. In fact, the bureau chief went around the office collecting that copy with the cover of Reagan and the Iran-Contra cover-up to get rid of it because he was so embarrassed by it. He didn't want it around the office even. So that was the kind of reaction that, and of course, it turned out that what I had reported was absolutely true. Years later, it came out after I left Newsweek, and this was after Judge Walsh had done his long Iran-Contra investigation, which also was being sabotaged by the government and undercut by elements of the media as well. When it came out that indeed Reagan had been involved in a cover-up, along with Vice President George H.W. Bush and others. But the fact is, we couldn't do those stories. That it became a point where you couldn't write about things even when you could prove them to be true because there was such hostility, not just from the government, not just from the political pressure groups, but from the media itself.
Yeah, is it a question of there was hostility or that those on the left just fall back in the face of hostility? It's like what you were talking about. But would you?
I would say mostly that the left became almost irrelevant during this period. It kind of took itself out of the play because it had shut down so much of its own media. You know, the magazines like Ramparts and news services like Dispatch News, they were ancient history by this point.
Well, you were talking before about how the Democrats just became timid, and when during the 80s when the word became liberal, oh, he's a liberal, and the liberals would say, no, I'm a progressive. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying, well, women can vote now, that's because of liberals. Mm-hmm. Your kids aren't working in mines, they're in schools, that's because of liberals. We don't have slaves because of liberals, et cetera, et cetera. Instead it was, oh, no, I'm not a liberal.
Right, and you did have, there were times, not often, but there were times when Democrats in Congress did act bravely, and they were almost always punished. For instance, when John Kerry picked up on a story that Brian Barger and I did at the end of 1985 about the Nicaraguan Contras getting themselves involved in drug trafficking. It was at that point we had multiple sources, we had documents, I had one source inside the White House talking to me about it, reading to me CIA documents about the Contras being involved in drugs. So there was no question it was true, and now, of course, even now the CIA has since acknowledged it was all true. But at the time, it was pretty controversial. And it was attacked by the New York Times and the Washington Post, and as well as the right-wing press like the Washington Times. But John Kerry, to his credit, at that point, he was still a young senator, fairly new, a junior senator, and he investigated this and advanced the investigation quite a bit, against great odds and against a lot of pressure. So he put out a report, which, you know, didn't go as far as it probably could have. It was actually a little on the timid side of itself, but still put out a lot of good information. And he was relentlessly attacked by the New York Times, the Washington Post. He was called by Newsweek a, quote, Randy conspiracy buff because of what he'd done. So after times, you know, to survive, politicians survive politically within this strange world we have in Washington, politicians also began, even if they did have brave inclinations, they became more and more timid.
I saw a story about Chuck Hagel, who's on his way to becoming the next defense secretary, basically apologizing to the Israeli lobby for his ill choice of words about Iran, basically moderating whatever he might have wanted to say before and turning it into, you know, I'm part of the team here, people, don't worry about me. So, you know, this is the political survival etiquette of the times we live in, with people kind of rushing for cover when they're challenged. But, you know, I think your work, Bob, is really important. I wanted to really call attention to it because I think it's very important that people know about Consortium News, that you continue to do the work that you're doing. And, you know, here at Progressive Radio Network, which is a startup really in itself, you know, I want to highlight the work of colleagues that I really respect and to try to get people more aware of all of these different sources, because there are voices out there, folks, who are motivated by real values and by a belief in truth. And I think Bob Perry has been for years. So, Bob, thanks so much for coming on and being with me, and I hope you'll come back.
Thanks, Danny. Anytime.
So there you go, Bob Perry. We're going to be taking a break in a second, but I just wanted to mention one thing also online. I've been working on public education as an issue, and I've finished a film this week on the DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx and its fight for survival. And if you go to facebook.com/DWC film, you can see our trailer and our promo and read some of the responses that the film is attracting. So please do that. Stay with us here on News Dissector Radio. We'll be back in a minute. We'll hear about another view about what's happening in the war in Africa.
find no dough, nothing to show. I'm all night, can't sleep right, my head's tight. Gotta buy food, clothes, books, and it looks like there's holes in my shoes. What to do? My credit card's full, and it's due. No job, no time, no reason, no rhyme.
Hey, Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on News Dissector Radio, now with Paul R. Levine, who's also participating in the program and is going to be adding his wit, his wisdom, and his music. And Paul R. picked out that song, which he'll tell us about now, because we're going to talk a little bit about this conflict in Mali, you know, which most people sort of came out of the blue, and it's the French are intervening there, but it's not just about France. The United States is deeply involved in all of this, although we don't read about that much in the papers. What's the song we just heard?
We heard from a group called Tanarawin, and they're Tuaregs, and the Tuaregs are a nomadic tribe in northern Mali. And northern Mali right now is where the crux of this this horrendous situation going on, where jihadis have taken over and turned the whole region, which is twice the size of Germany, it's primarily desert, into Sharia law, and over 400,000 people have escaped it. You know, from a musical standpoint, from just the musical part of my heart, it's so tragic because some of the most beautiful music in the world is coming out
Salif
of Mali.
Keita
Salif Keita came
one
from
of the great artists there. Also,
yeah, Oumou Sangaré. Although they're from Bamako, which is the capital, and there's a rich musical culture in America. We know it as desert blues. And it's starting to reach our ears. In fact, I think Tanarawin was on the Colbert Show. But Tanarawin and Kaira Arbi also does that type of music, and hopefully we'll hear from her a little later.
All right, so another song from Mali coming up. But, you know, the issues there are really important. In my blog today at newsdissector.net, I feature a report about the Mali government. Now, this is not the so-called jihadis lining people up and shooting them dead, you know, preemptive assassinations taking place of people they consider could be enemies there. So it's nasty. It's a war, and it's being complicated by foreign intervention. I do some work with a group called Sahara Reporters, SaharaReporters.com, that does Sahara television on YouTube. Every Saturday, it's a report from Africa by Africans. And this past week, they ran an interview with Professor Horace Campbell, a noted peace and justice international scholar, a professor of African American studies and political science at Syracuse University in Syracuse, New York. I went to Syracuse briefly. He has a book coming out very soon about these issues, and he's also very articulate. His book is called Global, NATO, and Catastrophic Failure in Libya. So Professor Horace Campbell was interviewed by Sahara TV, and that's up on YouTube, but here's what he had to say. Let's listen to parts of this interview, and we'll come back, play a little more music, and talk about it.
Oh, Hello, viewers. This is Sahara TV out of New York City. My name is Omoyele Sowore. As part of our show today, we're discussing the country Mali. That's a country that has been known to be peaceful and been in some kind of democracy over these years, just suddenly under attack from so-called Islamic militants. The story as we stand today is that former colonial masters led by France and, of course, Nigeria and several other West African countries from ECOWAS have gathered troops that are massing on Mali. And as we promised, we want to discuss this with scholars, and we also like to hear your views at some point. I just want to let you know that we have Professor Horace Campbell on the line with us. Professor Campbell is a noted international peace and justice scholar, and also he's the chair of the he's a professor of African American Studies and Political Science at the Syracuse University in Syracuse, upstate New York. He has a book coming out, he says, that's called Global, NATO, and Colossal Failure in Libya, and the book will be out in March. Professor Horace Campbell, you're welcome to Sahara TV.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Let's go into this directly. What do you think is happening in Mali? Why is the world, you know, suddenly interested in Mali? And how do you think we got here? Because, you know, apparently now France has been bombing Nigeria, sent troops over there. And there's been a lot of responses all over the world. And people need to understand this. And that's why we have you on our show today.
Well, I think your viewers should remember that it was 2 years ago that African politics changed with a revolution in Tunisia and in Egypt. With these two revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, we had counter-revolution in Libya. The Western financial speculators, along with their army, that is called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, called NATO, used the expedient of responsibility to protect to invade Libya and destabilize the country, creating a situation with militias and eventually executing the president, Muammar Gaddafi. Mali and South Africa are two countries in Africa that have a very strong, what they call, civil society. That is, people in Mali are organized at different levels, in trade unions, in youth groups, student groups, women's organizations, cooperative, Islamic organizations, and they have been active since 1992 to change the political process in Mali. Now, in the context where South Africa and Mali have this tradition of people organizing to defend their livelihood, the Western countries are afraid of the potential that the ideas of revolution that came from Tunisia and Egypt, that those ideas cascade and spread across Africa as they will. There's nothing to stop the revolutionary momentum, because the revolution is calling for one thing. The people of Africa want a better quality of life. The people of Africa want the resources and wealth of Africa to change their standard of living. The people of Africa want unity and reconstruction of Africa, and the people of Africa want peace. So if you listen to the Malian people today, the most important Malian singer, a woman, came out with a new song calling for peace and say that peace can come from the people of Mali. Now, here we have a situation where the worst imperialist in relationship to Africa for the past nearly 180 years, France invaded Algeria first in 1830. France has been involved in a brutal war against the Algerian people when they fought for independence. France assisted in destabilizing Africa with the Congo. France has supported military dictatorships all over Africa. How could France suggest to people that they are in Africa to help Africa? That's something African will not accept. However, Africans are put in a very difficult situation because the jihadists who destroyed one of the most important cultural centers in Africa, Timbuktu, these jihadists have been financed by the United States of America for the past 10 years under the so-called Pan-Sahel Initiative, and the United States of America, their Africa command, financed these jihadists to overthrow Gaddafi. So Africans were caught in a trap. What do you do against these jihadists? Can ECOWAS send troops to fight beside France, which is a bigger enemy than the jihadists? These are real problems, and these problems require clarity, organization, and political mobilization for peace in Africa. It cannot be short-term and be driven by the Western propaganda about what's going on in Mali.
Thank you, Professor.
There's Professor Horace Campbell, an interview he did with Sahara Reporters, which you can check out, Google them on YouTube. They do an interesting program every week, offering African perspectives on African issues, the kind of news that most Americans are not exposed to. But there are a couple of points that he raised here that are kind of would be very new to most people in America, particularly in light of this recent situation where Hillary Clinton was talking about what happened in Benghazi, the killing of an American ambassador, and all the Republicans were jumping up and down, saying there was inadequate security and all the rest of it. Now there's another perspective on all this, suggesting that this ambassador, who wasn't really an ambassador because he was in a consular office in not an official U.S. embassy in Benghazi, was involved in procuring arms and soldiers to fight in Syria. The United States was in alignment, says this professor, with these jihadis in Benghazi. And that this was what, you know, Gaddafi was opposing, arguing that if these jihadis are successful in Libya, their influence will spread elsewhere in Africa. And that seems to be what's happening. So there are several issues. One, there's the issue of jihadi fascism, you know, kind of imposing, a view on the people there, and also imposing their outlook, you know, the Sahara law and all this on people. That's one concern. But, you know, Mali had just recently become a democracy, and now that democracy has kind of been militarized and splintered, the U.S. government is actually flying in the supplies for the French and is very deeply involved in this intervention in Mali. The Benghazi situation has not been resolved whatsoever. There are still not only supporters of Gaddafi, but supporters of these jihadis, al-Qaeda, etc., in Benghazi, opposing what the United States and the West wants to do there. So it's a complex mosaic of interests and forces. But, you know, this is just one issue in the news that comes to us with no background, no context, no really attempt to interpret what's going on. And so we get instead this sort of knee-jerk battle between Republicans and Hillary Clinton. The Republicans saying, you didn't provide enough security. Hillary Clinton saying, yes, I did, or I didn't know about it, or whatever, whatever. But that was never the real issue. The question was, what has been American strategy in eastern Libya, in Benghazi, now in Mali? What is the United States doing in all these conflicts as we expand our interventions throughout the world into what's been called an empire of bases, where the U.S. is based all over the world? And these are the issues that we really need to examine more closely if we want to have any understanding of what's happening.
Yeah, it seems like the U.S. and its outlook toward the non-Western world is that the rest of the world was put there for our amusement and profit. And there's never been any real attempt at knowing the language, knowing the culture, knowing the history, the complex of ethnic groups, the whole idea of a tribal society. That's why we went into Iraq and Afghanistan with people not Are people not knowing the language, the customs? It's insane.
I was just thinking about the inauguration and, you know, Beyonce wasn't too comfortable being backed up by the Marine Band, you know. and you know, here's the United States Marine Anthem, you know, which is from, you know, from the halls of Montezuma in Mexico to the shores
of Tripoli
yeah. in Libya. This goes back into the 1840s. I mean, this is something that supposedly in the name of fighting pirates, the U.S. intervened. Back then, and you know, this was all also part of the whole slave trade and everything else that was coming out of Africa at the time. So there were always foreign interests manipulating the situation, and continue to do so today. So when we look at all of this, we need to really examine it with in a critical way. Ask some questions. Learn about the history of it. Find out who the players are. What are they doing? What is their strategic interests in all of this? And, you know, which is not to excuse barbarous human rights abuses, either by the jihadis or by the Mali government, encouraged and armed by the United States. Don't forget, the United States went in using NATO as its kind of tool, but claiming not to be involved, but arming, you know, and sending in aircraft that killed many, many people in Libya and destroyed the country. We still, to this day, don't know the full aftermath of that war and what its consequences are right now kind of happening. Yeah.
Or even the aforementioned of it. I mean, it never came out really who it was that we were allied with. What part of that rebellion were we working for?
I mean, this goes back to, you know, Afghanistan, where the United States was aligned with the Mujahideen, the people who later supported al-Qaeda, who we then later went in to stop. So, you know, it's a shifting set of alliances.
Yeah, and apparently the soldiers that America trained wound up being part of the group that took over the northern section.
Yeah, you know, exactly. They defected. These were troops trained by the African command of the U.S. Government, you know, supposedly to represent American and Western values and stability and all this. And a lot of them defected because the government there was so unresponsive to the people and so helping themselves to what resources there are in the country. So, you know, you have these conflicts that aren't simple to untangle, but the media here doesn't even try to untangle them, doesn't really explain anything with any depth. I mean, Al Jazeera, is doing reporting from Mali and has done some excellent programs, but you know, you don't see these on MSNBC or on other outlets in the United States, any attempt to really explain any of this. So all of this sort of goes by, you know, with a lot of a burst of polemical rhetoric. You know, we're fighting for freedom, we're against the terrorists, blah, blah, blah. In some cases, we're aligned with the terrorists, and this isn't being made clear.
Have we ever supported a democracy since the Marshall Plan after World War II? I think we always support the other side.
Well, I mean, I'd like to think at least, and I'm not so sure, the net effect of it all, they did support Mandela government in South Africa to try to help build a South African democracy. At the same time, part of the deals that they made there was to prevent the Mandela government from, you know, really fulfilling its promises to the people there in terms of a better life for all, in terms of jobs and other social programs. So, you know, the United States has imposed a set of interests on the rest of the world. And when I was in South Africa this summer, all of a sudden it was announced the price of gas at the pump is going up. Now, here's a country which is barely trying to stop the economy from imploding and collapsing. Now the gas of petrol, the price of petrol, is about to go. Why is it going up? Because all of a sudden, the South African government has decided not to import oil from Iran because of the pressure of Hillary Clinton and others about supporting sanctions against Iran. And so instead, in the name of democracy, they import oil from Saudi Arabia, okay, which is, you know, it's certainly no quality of difference in terms of democracy there. So, you know, we have all of these forces behind the scenes, don't get attention, don't get explained, don't get investigated. And that's why we need journalists like Bob Parry, who was on with us earlier, and others, efforts that we're trying to make. I just announced, you know, we hope next week to relaunch mediachannel.org with writing about the media from all over the world. And please look for it online if you do find it, and have some thoughts about it, comments, suggestions for what we should be covering. Write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. We'd like very much for your participation in all this and your help. So that would be very good. Polar here has looked at the clock and is asking, wondering, why is he wrapping up so quickly when we have so much time to go? But actually, the clock is wrong.
The clock is wrong.
The clock is off. It's now 5:54. So we to wrap up. So just a couple of announcements that are important. First up, we welcome Polar Levine to the program, and he'll be joining us. We've been attempting to find the best journalists and best analysts to offer content that you don't hear anywhere else here on News Dissector Radio. I want to reinforce my earlier appeal to help us get this campaign going to stop the drift towards more charter schools in New York and support public education. Please look at the trailer and the promo for my new film on DeWitt Clinton High School and its fight for survival. It's DWC film. And that's on Facebook, facebook.com/DWC film. I blog every day at newsdissector.net, and you're welcome to share your comments with me about the blog as well. And hopefully, if you're listening and you've come with me this far, you'll also do your bit or help to get the word out about this program, about PRN.FM, about what we're trying to do here. You can check out my article up on AlJazeera.com about the future of Al Jazeera America, which is not launched yet, but is in the process of getting organized and hiring people. So all of that is part of what we try to do here. Now we're going to end the program on this note and bring back some music from Mali that Pilar brought with him. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah, this is an artist named Kaira Arbi, and she's an extraordinary singer and songwriter, and writes a lot of songs about women's rights, which is a shaky thing to do in that area, particularly now. In fact, now in northern Mali, music is illegal. So I don't know what's happening to all these people. This is a song by Kaira Arbi about genital
mutilation.
Circumcision. Yeah, okay. Female circumcision.
Here it is. Thanks for being with us.